From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, our sports contributor weighs in on Ryan Braun's suspension and his sort of apology.
He really has to come clean and stop hiding behind, you know, half statements and things of that nature, because if he continues to do that, in a way he's just perpetuating what a lot of people believe were lies in the first place.
Why some Milwaukee girls will soon rock out at summer camp. Another use for your backyard grill, making smoked salt.
Amazing flavor that once you're done with your grilled piece of meat, you just ground a little bit of salt over it, and everybody goes, where did that smoke flavor come from? Or you can start selling it to your best friend.
Yeah. And the Canadian husband and wife duo White Horse joins us for an in-studio performance. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Milwaukee Brewers star player and former National League Most Valuable Player Ryan Braun has been suspended by Major League Baseball for the rest of this season for violating the league's rules on performance-enhancing drugs. Braun issued a statement after the 65-game suspension was announced, apologizing for the mistakes he made, but not specifically admitting that he used PEDs. Braun had long denied using such drugs, and a previous suspension had been overturned on a technicality related to the handling of a urine sample. Howie Magner writes about sports for Milwaukee Magazine's website, and he's senior editor at the magazine. He's also our sports contributor, and he joins us by phone this morning. Good morning. Nice to speak with you.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Mitch.
So Ryan Braun is lost for the rest of the season. He's admitted to mistakes, but not specifically to using performance-enhancing drugs. What do you make of the significance of the 65-game suspension and what Braun actually said in his statement?
Well, I do think that if the Brewers were going to have their best player be suspended for 65 games, that this was certainly the season for it to happen. Because, frankly, everything that could have gone wrong in this season has gone wrong in this season. So if you're looking for a positive aspect from a Brewers fan's perspective, I think that's about as close as you're going to get to it. As far as the statement itself, it was kind of one of those non-apology apologies that has become something of the norm as we've seen the whole performance-enhancing drug era play out in baseball and in other sports. I suppose on a certain level, you can understand why that's the case. There's a lot of talk that once a player admits to doing performance-enhancing drugs, then perhaps he opens himself up to some other form of legal retaliation or something like that. So I think there's been a history of being purposely vague when you're apologizing in cases like this as to what you're apologizing about. That's not going to go over too well with Brewers fans.
Do you think it's incumbent on Ryan Braun to say something additionally to Brewers fans and baseball fans in general?
If he wants to be forgiven entirely, then absolutely. I think one of the biggest things that Brewers fans are holding against him now and will continue to hold against him in the future, while the actual doing of the drugs is certainly bad in many of their eyes, but it's the lying about it that is really the crux of the issue for fans, I think. Because and not just for fans, but I would imagine for teammates and people in the media and people in the organization, there's a whole slew of people who damaged their credibility by trying to reinforce Braun's credibility. And so until he gives people a place to start fresh from, then it's hard to offer him a fresh start. I just think that he really has to come clean and stop hiding behind, you know, half statements and things of that nature, because if he continues to do that, in a way he's just perpetuating what a lot of people believe were lies in the first place. And frankly, here's the thing. You're right, Mitch. She has not admitted to doing the performance-enhancing drugs. It was conspicuously absent in his statement, and frankly, it was pretty vague in the statement that baseball put out. But I think there's a tacit understanding that everybody understands that this is what he's apologizing for. Well, then we need more details about that type of thing. How long did it go on? Where did he get them? Why was he so adamant? Why did he throw so many people under the bus while he was defending himself? And I think until those answers come out, until there's more of a full story told, then it's going to be really hard for Brewers fans to forgive him.
Do you think, does this taint everything Ryan Braun has accomplished in a Brewers uniform, or do we not know enough to make that blanket statement?
Well, certainly being suspended for a performance-enhancing drug violation, or at least a violation of the league's drug agreement, automatically taints you, because at the heart of that matter, it's branding you a cheater. And so if you cheated to accomplish your statistics, your performance, your awards, the wins that you helped the team to, then yeah, it's tainted on a certain level. Now, do you want to hedge it a little bit and say, well, he's not the only one cheating? And I saw stories where there were some people on the Diamondbacks, the Arizona Diamondbacks organization, who wondered if they were cheated out of their playoff victory back in 2011. Well, okay, if you can show that there was nobody on the Arizona Diamondbacks who cheated, then maybe you have a case. But, you know, all of that is really kind of secondary. If you're just getting to the heart of did Ryan Braun, are Ryan Braun's accolades tainted? I think the very simple answer is yes. Are the Brewers' accolades tainted? Probably yeah, as well, on a slightly lesser level. That doesn't denigrate the performances of the players who haven't, you know, admitted to anything or haven't been implicated in the whole performance-enhancing drug arena. But as a whole, you wonder, would the Brewers have been able to accomplish everything that they had done had Ryan Braun not been there? And that's probably not a likely scenario. And so I think you have to look at the accomplishments of the team through the same lens that you look at the accomplishments of Ryan Braun.
Well, and along those lines, if you're manager Ron Renicki or general manager Doug Melvin or owner Mark Attanasio, how do you view this news?
With disappointment. I mean, really, I don't know that there's any other way to do it. Probably disappointment with a heavy dose of anger, because on several levels, You were tacitly assisting in the story. You were defending him. You were saying that you supported him through all these allegations. And now, if this is to be believed, and you know, I understand that it's got to be hard from their perspective to come to terms with this, because they did spend so long defending him, and now you've got to do a 180, and instead of believing the story of Ryan Braun, you've got to believe the story of the people who were attacking him. Even last night in the Brewers clubhouse, some players still hadn't come around on that. Yovani Gallardo, the Brewers star pitcher, was asked very specifically if he believed that Ryan Braun used performance-enhancing drugs, and he still said no. He did not believe that. So you got the sense that there is still a level of hope on behalf of at least some people within the organization that there's a better explanation for this than the one that says that Ryan Braun cheated. And I guess if you go back to the old line that, hey, he hasn't admitted doing anything yet, then I suppose that still gives you a sliver of hope. But the other thing that you heard from the clubhouse a lot was, it is what it is, and he's a great guy, and we forgive him, and it's time to move forward.
But is it all behind the Brewers? I mean, is there a long-term financial aspect to this? I mean, they're going to save on the rest of Ryan Braun's contract this year, I believe, but you know, they still have a lot of money tied up with him through 2020. Do they hang on to Ryan Braun through thick and thin after the suspension is done?
I find it hard to believe that they're going to trade Ryan Braun next year. Or in the off season. For the simple point that, it's going to be really hard to get anything close to value for Ryan Braun because there are going to be a lot of other question marks from a lot of other teams out there about him. So I think it's unlikely that you're going to see an immediate trade, but you do bring up a good point, Mitch. The Brewers gave him that big contract extension based upon his level of performance, you know, while he may have been using performance-enhancing drugs. We still don't know the timeline of when all of this was, but let's assume for a second that he you know, some of those numbers came while he was using performance-enhancing drugs. Well, then their question is, okay, let's assume that he's going to be clean going forward. Is he still going to produce numbers on the level that is deserving of the type of contract that we're giving him? You, I suppose, would hope that Ryan Braun will still be an all-star caliber player going forward, but at this point, you just don't know. And so that really matters to a franchise that doesn't have, you know, a whole lot of payroll flexibility and can't just, you know, be like the New York Yankees, and if something doesn't work out, they cut their losses. The Brewers need to be really efficient with their payroll. And if Ryan Braun can't perform up to the level of a $15, $18, $20 million player, then it could cause problems for the Brewers down the line. As far as other financial aspects, look, the Brewers are so dependent on getting people out to Miller Park to help support that big payroll. They get so much revenue from the 3 million fans that come through the gates. But, you know, other teams rely a lot more on the television contract to help bolster the payroll. For the Brewers, it's really all about attendance. And it's going to be really interesting to see if the whole Braun saga has an impact at the gate. And if it does, then that's another level of a financial hit that the Brewers have to worry about. So there are still a lot of dominoes to fall here. And it's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out over the next 6 months, even next year, to see just how long the fallout stays with the team.
One last question for you. You had been one of the writers that had cautioned people not to be quick to judge Braun in the absence of hard evidence in months and years past. Do you feel burned by him?
I don't feel burned by him necessarily. I always kind of take the wait until this whole story comes out before making a judgment. It's kind of a general philosophy. So it wasn't necessarily something that I reserved for Ryan Braun. It's just kind of a general approach. Frankly, I still want to see the evidence. I still want to see what's out there because all we know now is we're assuming that Major League Baseball has all this evidence. But if I, you know, what I don't like is being lied to. And if you're asking me, am I offended or upset that Braun lied about these things? Then yeah, I think that you want the people that you write about, that you work with, to be genuine. And there doesn't seem to be a level of genuineness with Ryan Braun that you might have thought was there before all this new information came to light. So do I personally feel burned by him? Not necessarily. Look, I wasn't naive enough to think that it couldn't have been the case. I just thought that you really did want to see the whole story play out before you jump to any conclusions. Well, look, now we've seen a really good portion of the story play out, and now we know that Ryan Braun was not portraying himself as in light of the full facts. And now you can make the judgment. Now I don't worry about the rush to judgment anymore. I think we're all pretty safe in saying Ryan Braun did something wrong. He deserves to pay for it. He will pay for it. And the story going forward is, how is he going to repair his image? How are the Brewers going to recover from this?
Howie, thanks.
Thanks, Mitch. Take care.
Howie Magner writes the online Sports Nut column for Milwaukee Magazine, and he's senior editor of the magazine. He's also our regular sports contributor, and he joined us to talk about the news that Brewers slugger Ryan Braun has been suspended for the rest of the season for violating Major League Baseball's policy on performance-enhancing drugs. We'll take a quick break now, and in just a moment, a bunch of girls, guitars, drums, and a summer camp mix in Milwaukee this summer. We'll find out about the first Girls Rock Milwaukee when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. August 11th, several Milwaukee rock bands will get together and play a shared bill concert at Turner Hall. It's not the first time there have been multiple acts taking the stage there, of course, but it will undoubtedly be the first time all of the songs played will have come together in a week. It is the culminating experience of Girls Rock Milwaukee, the city's first girls rock camp, slated for August 5th through the 9th. And it's the invention of Valerie Lux and Ashley Smith, who are with us for an opening act. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Is this about rock and roll? Is it about being a girl, or is there something bigger at work?
I think it's about both. Rock Camp was originally founded in 2001 in Portland, Oregon, by a group of women out there. And the original intention behind the camp was to introduce music to girls in a way that would broaden it for women. There's so many women who are into music out there, but they're not represented well in bands. They're often the bass player, they're often the vocalist, and that's kind of where it stops. You know, there aren't a lot of women drummers out there. So they wanted to show girls that they could be anything, really, in rock. So they created the space for them to be there. There's also the second sort of point to Girls Rock, which is creating a open space for girls to be creative without judgment. So that's kind of our intention as well.
Well, and as you say, the Girls Rock Camp phenomenon has been around for a dozen years now. Do you see, is there going to be something distinctive about the stamp that you will put on this concept?
I think in time it will.
Right.
This is our first year of camp. We have been very, very lucky to have the other camps around the country give us lots of input and insight on what they've been doing, for some of them for many years. So right now we're using a lot of their input as our foundations. And as we grow and get bigger, I think it will definitely take on a uniquely Milwaukee.
We'll find our voice.
Exactly.
Why did you want to do it here?
Because Milwaukee didn't have one. I actually wanted to volunteer with Chicago Girls Rock for many years. And this year, I think I just was thinking about signing up for it. And it dawned on me that Milwaukee just didn't have the camp. So I asked Ashley, who is a rock and roller in her own right, if she would help me.
Oh, thanks,
Al. If she would start the camp with me. So we decided to do it here.
Now, Ashley, you got to be a rock and roller without having gone to Girls Rock Camp, or did you at some point?
I have never attended a Girls Rock Camp.
How did it work for you to get where you have gone, and also why did you want to do this?
I started off going to a lot of basement shows in my late high school years and started seeing other women in bands and thought to myself that I wanted to do that. So I joined a few bands here and there over the course of the last 10 years. Had I had an opportunity like Girls Rock, maybe I would have been introduced to a lot of other music at an earlier age and got my start a little bit earlier.
Well, and I feel like we're talking about the camp without talking about the camp itself, the experience of the camp. Give us a sense for what that experience is going to be like for how many campers are you going to have?
We have 32 campers this year. Hopefully next year we'll have more, but we wanted to start smaller the first round. They're going to come to camp, and on the first day of camp, they're going to be divided into 8 bands. So 4 members of each band. They'll play guitar, bass, drums, and there'll be a vocalist. So the girls, before they've come to camp, have already picked their instruments, what they want to be in the band. So we'll put them together, and then they will spend the week writing one song, one original song. And they will have band coaches that help them through that. They'll do some workshops during the week around women in rock history. We're going to do a couple of other workshops that are more around empowerment and assertiveness and some of the, you know, addressing like women in media, some of those concepts. And then at the end of the week, their bands are going to play a rock show with their songs that they wrote.
At Turner Hall.
At Turner Hall.
How does it work with such a broad age range? I imagine that teenagers bring something different to the table musically than, say, an 8-year-old does.
Yeah. Well, we've got the age ranges of 8 to 16. We're going to break the girls up two different ways. Age being the number one, but then musical ability. Because we've got some girls that have applied to camp that have far more music experience than, say, some of the 14-year-olds that are coming. So we'll be looking at those two pieces.
Well, and who are the kinds of people that you have guiding the kids through this?
It's all volunteer-based, people who are teachers, nurses, people who are women who are just in bands who want to support the cause. We have a great group of people with broad experience and broad attributes to bring to the table.
Women and men.
Women and men.
Well, and at this stage, you say you're still looking for volunteers to fill out the roster?
We still need a little bit of help for camp week. Camp is Monday through Friday, so we still need people to come and just be floaters at camp to help us move equipment around. We're still looking for people who might be interested in doing some instrument instruction. We still need assistance with the band coaches. Each of the bands are assigned a coach that works with them through the entire week, helps them write their song, helps them create their band identity. Each band has a coach, but the coaches need an assistant still. So we're still looking for some help there, too.
We also need some donations of gear. So if anyone out there has a bass just lying around or, you know, a practice amp, we could use that sort of thing as well.
Yeah, and we would be happy to borrow it and return
it. Yes.
You know, you mentioned messages that the media sends out, and there are bands out there that are very much directed specifically at adolescent girls. And I wonder whether an experience like this is as much about expanding kids' musical horizons, whether or not they go on to be in a band themselves years down the road.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
If I would have had an experience like this, I think at age 12, I think that my musical life would be a lot different. It took me a while to find the underground or the more feminist approach to music. I was very much into pop music for a long time, and there's nothing wrong with pop music, but I think it's important to have for anyone to have a well-rounded idea of what's out there musically.
Yeah, I think it's just about presenting girls with a different image. Not that, you know, not that there's anything wrong with any one image in particular, but the media does tend to present one side of an image of women often. And we would like to present another side of it.
Well, and I wonder, do you think the kids were going to get some of those other messages, the empowerment and self-esteem and such, just from the experience of what they're doing?
Definitely.
I
think just the act of getting together and collaborating with four girls that you don't know, creating something, and then standing up on a stage and in front of hundreds of people and presenting what you've created is empowering in and of itself. And just having people there to listen to you and judge you not on necessarily how you look or how good you are, but that you've created this one thing is just something they can take and apply in many parts of their lives.
Kind of is amazing to think of the blank slate that exists before this starts and what will come out of it at the other end.
It's kind of terrifying.
Yes.
I'm so excited, though. Ashley and I have already said we're probably going to bawl and cry the whole time the showcase is going because we'll be so proud of these girls. Because I think it takes a lot of bravery for them to do this. And these are 12, 13-year-old girls that are going to get up there and pour their hearts out on stage. I think it's pretty great.
Are they going to walk out the door with a recording of this too?
Yeah, and a video. We've got a couple volunteers that are recording it for us to put together CDs and then a video as well.
Well, outstanding. Valerie, Ashley, thank you so much and best of luck with this and come back and see us again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ashley Smith and Valerie Lux are the co-founders of Girls Rock Milwaukee, a camp for 8 to 16-year-old girls running at the beginning of August at the Zalazzo Center at UWM. The session is filled to capacity, but you can learn how to attend the concert at Turner Hall from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Keep listening. Chef and Lake Effect contributor Michael Fecker has some thoughts on a summer of food when we return on Milwaukee Public Radio. of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. For many of us, summer cuisine means steaks or chicken breasts or kebabs or just plain old brats outside over an open flame. And for sure, this is the ideal time of the year to do some grilling, but Milwaukee chef, educator, and Lake Effect contributor Michael Fecker thinks of something else when it comes to summer grilling, which he shares with our Stephanie Lecce.
When it comes to summer, for me, suddenly the actors change and the main actor become vegetables and the supporting cast are maybe protein and here and there. So I love grilling altogether.
That's interesting that you say the vegetables would become kind of the main stars of the show. What are you doing with the vegetables? You know, what can we do to dress them up a little bit and really make them stand out against, you know, perhaps the brats and the burgers?
Right. I think the brats and the burgers can be there, but in minimal ways, as far as I'm concerned. To me, I would love to talk to you about the tricks involved when it comes to grilling vegetables, because we have various kinds of vegetables. We have vegetables that are very high water content, such as bell peppers. And we love grilling bell peppers because they maintain their shape and they're easier due to their waxy skin and they slide a little bit better on the grill. Asparagus is something else that we love to grill, for example. But the best way to approach that is you always blanch asparagus prior to grilling it. At least
right.
I do.
Now, what is blanching for those of us who are less culinarily inclined?
Exactly. That's a great question. Why? Because I'm here to answer those. So this is the difference between blanching and boiling. When you blanch something, you partially cook it in boiling water. Make sure that the water is salted. And you shock it and you stop the cooking process in ice water. When we boil something, we start the ingredients in boiling water and we follow through the cooking process until consumption. That means we cook it all the way through. Why do we blanch? By blanching an ingredient, you open the pores of that ingredient, and due to the pores being open, it absorbs the hot water. And once you shock it, it closes its pores and it maintains the extra liquid within it. When you heat it again on the grill, the pores opens up, creates internal steam, and cooks all the way through and gives you those grill marks. So potatoes, for example, my kids love potatoes. They love corn. And what I do is I was in the market the other day, and it was beautiful. You had all these different colored potatoes and fingerlings, you know, purple, you know, ivory. You had reddish. It was beautiful. So I get those. I blanch them first. And when my friends are over, I toss those with a little bit of olive oil and chopped rosemary and just grill them on the cold side. Whoever is listening, make sure that you make your grill in a two-zone grill. That means you have one side that is extremely hot, and then you have another side that is medium to low.
Now, why is that important to have those two zones?
We start the cooking process on the hot side to get the grill marks and to sear the ingredients, which means closing the exterior pores that is exposed to the grill. And then we take it and finish the cooking process on the colder side so there is rotating heat instead of direct heat. We always make that mistake, myself included, that we start on that hot side and we finish on this hot side. What happens? A hot surface absorbs and pulls out moisture, so your meat tends out to be over-grilled and very dry, or your vegetables release all the water content and they dry out on you and become stringy. For those of you that have made that mistake, you have seen asparagus, for example, becomes this stringy thing that you have no idea, why can't I cut this? You know, that's one of the main reasons. At the same time, when you do double zoning of grilling, you can do many other things on that grill, like smoking your salt. What does that mean? You know, we take some kosher salt, we place it on an aluminum foil, we spray it with a little bit of water, and once we're done with the grilling, we just close the grill and we place the salt on the cold side, we close the grill and we walk away. The hot side keeps creating smoke, and it smokes your salt.
Okay, and so then what is the benefit of smoking our salt? It just adds some more flavor?
Amazing flavor that once you're done with your grilled piece of meat or just a piece of chicken in the kitchen, you just ground a little bit of salt over it, and everybody goes, where did that smoke flavor come from?
Oh.
Or you can start selling it to your best friends.
Yeah. Now, how long do we leave, say, a vegetable compared with a meat on the hot part and then transfer it to the less hot zone?
Great question as well. Let me tell you something about the way we grill and the mistakes that we make when it comes to grilling. We have the tendency of taking a piece of meat or vegetable, placing it on the grill, and constantly messing with it and pulling it up and down, pushing it around. Just leave it as it is, and you do something that we call 45-degree grilling. That means you never take one ingredient and you flip sides of that ingredient after a minute or two on the grill. The reason for that is because once you start taking that radiant heat that is coming off of your grill and exposing it to that side of the vegetable or the meat, that side is already starting the searing process. So all you do after a minute on vegetables and after 2 minutes on meat, you turn that meat or in vegetable 45 degrees on that same side. It is not, if you see many of these diamond-shaped grill marks that come to your table, that is not only to be dramatic. That has a reason behind it. So when you turn it 45 degrees, that same side is constantly being exposed to that heat. So it sears beautifully for you. Then you do the same thing, and now you flip it over to the other side, and another 45. Again, 1 minute on vegetables, 2 minutes on meats per side.
Okay.
And then you move it to the cold side and you let it sit until you're comfortable with it. Remember one more thing about vegetables. When you put it and move it to the cold side and you allow the rotation of the heat to cook it through, you want to keep it on a solid surface container because vegetables have juice and the juice runs. And as it runs inside the grill, you're not going to be benefiting from it. You want to maintain that juice within that ingredient and keeps it warm as well.
We've talked a lot about the vegetables, and we've mentioned a little bit about the meats. In addition to the salt, are there some interesting things and simple things we can be doing to our meat to kind of dress it up?
Absolutely. I got to tell you what I do, and this is not just because I'm a chef or I love food, which I know every one of you that are listening love food. We all speak food. I do something different with my meat. I always start my meat in the oven inside the kitchen prior to the grilling day.
Interesting. Now, why do you do that?
That you're starting the rotating heat around the oven, within the oven, and you're searing the meat and you partially cooking the meat. So when it goes on the grill, all you're doing, you're getting the grill flavor and the grill marks and you're finishing the cooking process. That way you're not standing on the grill and slaving while your friends are having fun, which I promise you, if you're slaving and you are stressed out with the food that you're trying to produce, your friends are going to taste that stress. So when you have fun and doing this, it's going to be much easier for you. Another thing that I do with my steaks or with my meat, I usually use, when it comes to grilling, a large piece of roast or a loin of beef that is a larger piece. I roast the whole piece to a rare or a medium rare with nice brown searing on the outside. Then the day later, I slice it, get it ready for the grill, and I go and finish it on the grill. Why do I do that? Again, as you said, if you take one tiny little steak and try to sear it, you have the tendency of overcooking it in the oven. But when you do a large piece, you cook it all the way through, it gets nice and crusted, and then you slice. Then all your friends are going to go, how did he crust the edge of that steak on the grill? That's how you suddenly mesmerize people and they can't figure out what's going on. And that's how conversations are created. That's how you go one step further when it comes to cooking and you just don't look at food as being a ritual. You look at it as an experience. Once you have very, very well-cooked steaks with seasoning and everything, all you need is a brush of olive oil the next day on the grill and you're only using the olive oil as a lubricant so the ingredient doesn't stick to the surface. By the way, everybody, one more thing about grilling. You always have a spray bottle with water next to you when you're grilling because those flames that arise from the minute the meat or the oil hits that grill, you put them off right away. Otherwise, you're going to get that burned flavor and that fuel flavor on your steak, which you don't want.
Summer is also somewhat synonymous with farmers markets, and I want to have you talk about how you go about picking your fresh ingredients. What are you looking for that, you know, maybe a less experienced culinary eye would notice as you're going through a market?
I think, to be honest with you, there are many, many eyes these days that pick out exactly what I do, and that is freshness, firmness, and lack of denting in your ingredients. But the beauty of what farmers market do for me right now, I opened a new restaurant Il Mito on the east side, so I'm very much involved in the east town farmers market. I'll be starting something that's called Shopping with Chef Fecker, So you're going to walk through the farmer's market with me. We're going to pick out things, and I'm going to answer your questions just about those things. So our East Town Association and I are hopefully teaming up to create something like that for you guys out there. But going back to your question, when you pick out ingredients, don't pick size. Pick firmness, crispiness, and freshness, because you do not want a baby carrot that is not a baby carrot anymore. You know, you want a baby carrot that is really baby carrot, and also it is deep in color. And also the best way for you, just for example, to test a carrot is not looking at the carrot itself, looking at the green stems of the carrot and how fresh they look. Beets, another. If the stems look wilted, the beet is old. Asparagus, you want to make sure that you take the asparagus, forget about the tips. Take it and turn it around and look at the stem at the end, and has that turned woody on you or have not? Those are the things that I look for. Apricots right now. I am just addicted to apricots. I mean, I'm going crazy. I'm seriously. Peaches and apricots is just great. Watermelon is another thing. Oh, by the way, we talked about grilling and we didn't talk about watermelon. How dare I? And the pineapple. An amazing, amazing dessert that I want you to try at home is taking some watermelon, taking the skin off, slicing it in thick enough sizes that is one per person, brushing it. Listen, don't freak out now. Listen, brush it with a little bit of olive oil and sprinkle some sea salt and black pepper on it and grill it. Now, remember, watermelon is going to release its flavor, water content very fast. So you want that hot side. 30 seconds per side. Grill it, get the grill mark, put it aside in a nice platter. It's going to release its water, and it's going to become like a sauce. Drizzle a little bit of reduced balsamic vinegar on it, and you will love me forever.
Well, Chef Michael Fecker, thank you so much for coming in and sharing these ideas with us.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Chef Michael Fecker is the purveyor of Il Mito Restaurant in Wauwatosa, Il Mito East in Milwaukee, and the host of a weekly TV show, Fecker's Kitchen, and he's also an occasional Lake Effect contributor. You can find links to more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce. One last break, then we're joined by Luke Doucette and Melissa McClellan, the Canadian husband and wife that make up the band White Horse. A chat and in-studio concert are next on Lake Effect. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. At first blush, the Canadian band called White Horse has a sound reminiscent of any number of Americana or roots groups. An acoustic country tinge, sweet harmonies, literary lyrics. But listen for a while and you'll notice there's something darker and more complex always lurking beneath the surface. At the core of the group are Luke Doucette and Melissa McClellan, who had been playing music together before their romantic partnership developed. Before a February concert at Shank Hall, the husband and wife stopped by the Lake Effect studio to talk and play a few songs from the album The Fate of the World Depends on This Kiss, including this one called Wisconsin. Drink into
busting unions in Wisconsin and praising Jesus in the schools. Keep the science in the basement, speaking tongues and making fools.
White Horse, Melissa McClelland and Luke Doucette in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Well, that is a killer song called Wisconsin.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The subject matter that kind of kicks off that song, it's, of course, still pretty fresh here in Wisconsin.
For sure. Mm-hmm.
Do you think – is there a particular challenge in writing a timeless song about a timely event?
Yeah. I mean, I think you look at what Neil Young did with Ohio, and he pulled it off. I mean, you have to write a good song, right? Because essentially the music is first. Any kind of topical stuff for the politics or – you know, anything that's anchored by reality. And I say anchored because music is sometimes better when reality doesn't play a role. But I think the music has to be – if the music's not the most important thing, then you've failed.
Yeah, and, you know, I think this was maybe one of the first times we've gone down a social commentary path. We don't do that too often, but I think we're starting to do it more and more. And Luke started off with the union busting verse, the opening verse, and then it kind of went off into a lot of other issues that seem kind of in the forefront of our minds anyways these days.
You know, with the album being called The Fate of the World Depends on This Kiss, it's a bit of a wink towards some of the sort of more apocalyptic things that we've been seeing happening. I don't know if it's just this has been a particularly apocalypse-obsessed year or if it's just that I'm noticing it more in the media. I'm not really sure. But, you know, obviously the song makes reference to Zuccotti, which is where the Occupy movement sort of sprouted its wings in New York. And it's the song's not about Governor Scott Walker per se, and it's not about the Occupy movement per se, but it certainly it's our way of saying, wow, these things can happen. And you sort of strangely being sort of white middle class people that we are, we have a choice to participate or to be ignorant, you know, and regardless of your take on it, regardless what you think. And it's an interesting position for musicians to be in because some people don't want to hear from us other than to sing songs about heartbreak and alcoholism.
I want to talk a little bit about your sound because in many of your songs, you have this sound that, I don't know, it starts out deceptively simple, maybe, and suddenly there are these dark and complex elements that get thrown in. Is there a metaphor in there somewhere?
Probably. Oh. I mean, I think we pick at each other's work enough that it usually ends up being a lot more elaborate than the initial creative idea. Yeah. So maybe that's a metaphor for our marriage. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a fan of – I think I want to say it was T-Bone Burnett. Maybe I'm misquoting him, but – somebody was talking about songwriting and saying keep the melodies simple and the harmonies complex. And that literally that's good advice, I think, but also sort of figuratively or metaphorically, I think that's good advice too, you know, like do simple things, but do them elaborately and do them well.
Yeah. We never want to, you know, get too far down the rabbit hole. You know, we want people to be able to connect to the melodies and all that. But at the same time, we can't help ourselves, but have fun with it.
Well, it's hard to read a review of your music without some reference to the idea that you've taken, and I'm using air quotes for people who can't see it, traditional country or roots music, and you've added an electronic feel to it. And I wondered why no one ever suggests that you've taken electronic sounds and added a layer of traditional or roots music to them.
Well, I guess we've been playing music long enough that certainly in our case, people understand that we started off as sort of more roots-based, you know, whether that's Americana or blues or country or folk, whatever you want to call it. And the electronic component was sort of a late blooming element of what we do, and it became about as a result of trying to make our live show more interesting, and all of a sudden we're using loops. But it's really important to us that people understand that everything that you hear off the stage was created that day, that evening on the stage.
Yeah, they are organic loops. You know, we're not – electronic is a bit of a stretch, but it's definitely – it is an element for sure.
You know, when was the last time you heard roots music or Americana done with any kind of electronic component whatsoever? I mean, I can think of a few examples. I think Beck has done it. You know, Beck takes Delta blues and puts hip-hop beats underneath it, and I love him for that. I think that's a really cool fusion. But, you know, we didn't set out to do that. It's nice to know that accidentally that's what happened, but that wasn't our goal.
Yeah, it really wasn't. So it's been an interesting result of what we're doing.
Yeah.
Well, and it strikes me, I think people use the term electronic almost as shorthand for canned and sampled.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in fairness, we are creating samples. We're just building the samples on stage. You know, they don't exist inside a sampler. We don't push a button and they play. We actually have to build them, which means sometimes we screw them up. Like we're on stage and we'll start playing a beat. And we'll loop it, and it comes back sounding
wrong.
Like this.
And we're like, wait, we're going to get this right. We're going to get this right.
Do you think people appreciate that kind of spontaneity?
I think they do. I mean, we're making ourselves really vulnerable up there, and not to the point where, you know, we want it to be awkward for everyone involved.
We also don't want it to be a sort of – we don't want to put a clown nose on the music either.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's not something we would ever do deliberately to get a laugh.
Yeah. And that kind of thing doesn't happen – you know, it happens maybe once every like 10 shows.
Well, speaking of vulnerability, is there another song you wanted to play for us?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, this is a song that Melissa and I wrote on a cruise ship on the Kayamo musical cruise, which involved Lyle Lovett and Emmylou Harris and Sean Colvin.
Sean Colvin was there. Yeah.
As wonderful an event as that is, playing music for all those people who are there to listen to music and getting to sort of rub elbows with some of those great songwriters, you're still sort of essentially trapped on a floating casino when you're in a cruise ship. And the song is about us surviving that experience together.
Touch my toes.
All the running and the talking, yeah, now everybody knows.
You never speak, but I can hear you as you sing out from your mismatched eyes. They are the eyes.
They are the eyes.
They are the eyes.
I will to die with.
Nothing more to share.
We've gone from one wave to another and back again to where
we go when guitars are hungover and the songs are fast asleep.
I feel the flesh wounds in my heart, but they are mine for me to keep.
In your pocket or your fist or in your mind, but they come to you by your ears.
They are the ears.
Yeah, they are the ears.
They are the ears that I will sing to.
White Horse and Mismatched Eyes in Studio C1. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I love the kind of feel that's a musical conversation going on between the two of you. Not just the lyrics, but the way your guitars are speaking to each other.
Oh, thank you.
It's you were talking about vulnerability before, and that was really about vulnerability with you up there in the audience here and the stuff that you're producing. Is there a vulnerability in your relationship existing in a public arena?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, you know, there's the classic – there's just the dynamic that exists. You know, you're not supposed to work with your spouse, period. You know, and not only are we working together, but we're touring together. And so, you know, we're within slapping distance of each other for sometimes 8, 10, 12 weeks at a time, literally. I mean, not that we slap each other, but I mean, we're that close, right? And so, yeah, we're you know, we realize the risk we're taking, and that does make us vulnerable. But at the same time – it's not like we had a normal sort of a more – I'll use the term normal – domestic life at some point and we decided to do this. We've been working together, you know, before we were a couple. We were working together as colleagues, I suppose. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know if you can use that term.
Yeah, I mean, it's all been very natural for us, but I know what you mean as far as, you know, placing our relationship in the public eye as far as, you know, interviews and doing press things and people talking about us or even people responding to us after a show, you know, talking about, oh, you guys look so in love and barf. It's like, yes, we are, but we're a normal married couple too, you know.
Yeah.
we have good days, we have bad days. And I think mostly we feel very lucky that we get to share this passion. I think that's the glue for us. That's the thing that keeps it so strong.
This comes up a lot. You know, it's every interview we've done, we end up talking about our relationship. And, you know, I'm curious to see how I'll feel about it in a couple of years. I might end up like a sort of cantankerous Bob Dylan where I refuse to talk about it or I insult the journalist. I hope not, because I would rather not get to that point. But what has occurred to me lately, which is kind of a relief, is that it's not the most interesting thing about this band. You know, yes, we're married, and if people see us at work and they want to interpret 99% of what we do as chemistry, when in fact 90% of what we do is just us being at work, we may have moments like any two people might. Mm-hmm. But the way we make our music, you know, with the loops and stuff when we play live, and you just mentioned the musical conversation between us. You know, I think those things are more interesting than the fact that we're a married couple. And that'll be nice when that settles in for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, so then let me ask you a more mundane question. You grew up in Manitoba.
I did.
You grew up in Ontario.
I did, yes.
Whitehorse is, of course, the capital of the Yukon Territory.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some larger significance to the name or you liked it?
I think we just wanted to keep it Canadian. I was actually born in the States but grew up in Canada. And we thought Whitehorse would be cool because it's a very remote place, kind of mysterious. A lot of Canadians don't ever get to see Whitehorse. We've been there a bunch of times, and it's beautiful. It's lovely. The people are wonderful.
When we conceived of this band, when we talked about it, the images we had in our mind of the kind of music we were going to make were going to be stark, and we intended to employ a lot of space as opposed to filling space. We wanted space to be a big part of the sound.
Luke, Melissa, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And what do you want to leave us with?
This is called Out Like a Lion. I'm not yours.
You are mine. Let that sink in like the mist.
Melissa McClelland and Luke Doucette are otherwise known as Whitehorse. Their latest album is called The Fate of the World Depends on This Kiss, and they stopped by the Lake Effect Studio before a concert this past winter at Shank Hall. John Strelecki engineered our in-studio performance. That's a wrap for Tuesday's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.
Yeah, I came in like a lamb, out like a lion.